Hey, here we are. Going to give people a few minutes to show up, but welcome to Delta Green Twitch and our Q&A on Iconoclasts. Here we have historian, author, game designer, Adam Scott Glancy, and then Shane's also here. Yeah.
Wow.
I'll be doing the twitching for the Twitch.
Yeah, that's what it's named for.
When you said historian, author, game designer, it's like, what, Ken Heitz showing up? I keep forgetting that I am the best value Ken Heitz, you know?
Dancer, hip-hop artist. So how y'all doing today? How was everyone's glorious Thursday?
As Thursdays go, it's just fine, I suppose. Not particularly, it's not quite the weekend, not the beginning of the week. And none of that matters when you're, you know, self-employed.
And oh, what's the name of the cat that still wants pets?
Yeah, Pie. This is Pie. Named by my wife Pie because she is a piebald pattern cat. So that's why she got named Pie. She is our.
Is she going to eat her someday?
How's that?
Not because you're going to eat her someday?
No, not because we're going to eat her. She may end up feasting on our eyeballs once we've fallen over dead, you know, in the house. But no, we hadn't had any plans to eat her. There's a lot of good meat on this. I'm not saying that this cat isn't a chunk, and there are some good, you know, she'd make a fine gravy, right? You know, but
now that you're thinking about it,
yeah,
you know.
But that wasn't the original plan. The original plan was just to hang out with her and pet her a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the subs. Not Punished and Mr. Alex Reynolds. We will use that money to buy another chunky cat to preserve Pi's life. Yeah. A less charismatic cat.
One with fewer toes because she is our polydactyl baby. If she reaches out to poke me for, you know, more petting, she will probably see all the extra toes she's coming at you with.
All right. So we're here to learn about Iconoclasts. As Skeletorso says, I'm here for the Glancy. So before we open up questions to the audience for the author of the campaign and its editor and the guy who talks on Twitch and the guy who actually knows how to run Twitch, who he's hired to help him. That would be Mr. Baswell there of Coyote and Crow and other fine game products like New Game Never Played. Let's just talk about, so you mentioned this a little bit in the campaign book when you talked about the inspiration for the campaign being one of rage. As the guy who wrote God's Teeth, I totally understand that. So do you want to go on about how Iconoclasts came into being? Yeah.
Well, it's really just that simple. I mean, I watch the news stories of these gleeful lunkheads, you know, smashing these irreplaceable artifacts. I mean, it's an old story. The Taliban did that before they got, run out of town the first time when they were blowing up the Buddhas in Afghanistan. They're back for more of that. And not to say that the Christians didn't do some damage to the Library of Alexandria at the time, but there is an oft-repeated bit of what is likely Christian anti-Muslim propaganda saying that as they rolled through Alexandria in the 700s or so, so what would you do with the library? And the quote was something like, well, if the books don't contradict the Quran, then there's no need for them. You know, they're extraneous. If they do contradict the Quran, then they're blasphemous and have to be destroyed. And there is, even though that story is quite probably like Byzantine propaganda against Islam, unfortunately, there's always somebody available who can sink to the level of the propaganda. You know what I mean? There's always, and ISIS is it. ISIS was everything your grandparents warned you Islam was going to be. Kind of like how meth and crack were everything our parents told us marijuana was going to be, you know, but it never turned out to be that way.
meth is a Republican's idea of what every drug is.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
like ISIS is a Republican's idea of the entire religion.
Yes, the entire religion of Islam. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so they managed to get there. I mean, they managed to be all the worst things they could be, especially to their fellow Muslims. Holy shit. Yeah. And, one of the things they got right on top of was erasing Iraq and Syria's cultural past. And part of that isn't just about picking out things that they define as blasphemy. One of the things that they dynamited early on was the alleged tomb of Noah. There was a site that, and since, you know, Islam is the third revelation, Noah's actually, you know, Noah's a thing.
Pretty deep Noah, in there, yeah.
Noah exists. They absolutely think, yeah, there was a flood, and Noah put everyone in the boat, and that happened. Mm-hmm. And ISIS blew up, the tomb, because they've got this hard-on about there not being, that graves and, mausoleums are therefore temples and sites of worship, and that distracts from the one true God, and you can't have, you know, these icons, you know, they're big on destroying that. Even destroying things that were sacred or revered by their fellow Sunnis, much less their Shiite cousins. They were just,
yeah, the ISIS theocracy is the equivalent of the evangelical Christian guy who has like the word Leviticus tattooed on him in Old English.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Well, I bet you didn't read that book. Like, are we just tattooing the ones we didn't read on us?
Yeah. You just know that Leviticus is very handy for pointing out the people that you hate, and exactly. Therefore, you know, God hates the same people I hate, so I must be on the side of right. You know, I better get a tattoo of that.
Yeah,
in my polycotton blend shirt, and my shaved face, and everything else that they didn't choose to read in Leviticus. But yeah, I watching them destroy artifacts, you know, destroy irreplaceable artifacts, and it was, I'll admit, that got to me almost more than the initial stories of people getting killed.
I sympathize. It was unique. Like, you get to, sadly, in the modern war, you get to see people killed every day. But like, you don't get to see a dark age recorded on, like, the creation of a dark age recorded on video. You come after the library burned down. Like, you come after they razzed the castle. But like, now they had like a shitty 1990s camera they stripped out of some poor blasted studio, and they're recording like, oh, let's erase Mithras from the world of any.
But it took a while, unfortunately, for me to kind of get grip to the idea that every Yazidi that they exterminated was as individual and as unique as these ancient survivals, these of art from the past. You know, I mean, it's unfortunate to say that, you know, as someone who studied archaeology and history and school, I had, you know, this, my first sort of moment of horror was the destruction of these ancient cultural things. But it sort of eventually dawned on me that the two were related. That part of the destruction of these ancient artifacts is about, it's about the process of genocide. And certainly it's unfortunately one of the things that went on in North America. There's a petroglyph in the United States that has been destroyed. The Thunderbird. I want to say it was in like Missouri or something. It was this big petroglyph that was on visible from the Mississippi River, I think, and it got blown up or wrecked, or we harvested granite or something out of it. And it's kind of like saying, well, no, that it's gone now, so no one was ever here. Unfortunately, it's a little bit like what, I like Mount Rushmore as much as the next guy, but slapping it down on somebody else's sacred land is kind of part of that process of bulldozing the things that show that there was somebody here before us. you know?
Yeah, you can't mourn it as much as people, but, you know, the Monuments Men had a job to do that was legitimate and, you know, part to, you know, the Nazis were trying to erase significant swaths of history. Yeah.
If you erase the fact that these people were here, then, you know, two generations from now, somebody's going, well, how can we even prove they were here? Do you have any photographs? Oh, if you have any photographs, I promise they're fake news. They're photoshopped. You know, remember how, what was his name? Yezgoda? I'm suddenly forgetting the name of the NKVD officer who is famously removed from pictures with Stalin as the commissar vanishes. But it's part of that process. You know, you by starting over with the year zero, you get to pretend you get to control the past. And George got it right with that whole thing about he controls the present, controls the past, you controls the past, controls the future. You can absolutely dictate reality once you're in charge of what history is. It's the same formula that Pol Pot used when they started over their calendar at year zero and renamed the country, you know, Kampuchea, renaming these swaths of Iraq and Syria as the caliphate was sort of part of that process of genocide. And so seeing that and seeing the sort of crimes that were even being revealed to us in 2016, and the bad news is that as time's gone by, we've just learned more and more and more and more about this regime, and none of it is good, ever. All of it is the kind of sadism you would expect from, you know, an adolescent child, you know, that, you know, in sort of like
with an RPK.
Coming up with new ideas of how to be horrible. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, we could sure shoot them, but what if they were on fire first? Or what if we, you know, ran over them with a tank? Or what if we put them in a cage and slowly lowered it into a swimming pool? I mean, it seems bizarre and, you know, unfathomable, but they went there. They absolutely went there. ISIS or ISIL, or the caliphate, or whatever you call it, you know, became this almost cartoonish fascist regime. And yeah, watching them do that, you know, we've all grown up with our horror stories. We all grown up with our weird fiction. We all know that when you fuck with the artifact, you know, it splits open and, you know, Thoth or Ra or Odin or whatever it is comes spilling out and steps right in the middle of your face for fucking with, you know, their sacred object from
they really did just sort of walk right into the trope in the real world. Like, we live in a horrible hell place where none of that's real. But like, if in the world of Delta Green, where there's archaeologists, if you show them like blowing up ancient gates, you're like, God damn it. They're gonna summon more demons.
They're gonna fuck up the elder signs that were there. God damn it!
You want demons? Yeah, demons. Yeah.
This is one of the few moments where I feel like if there were any justice in the universe, our world would be more like that of Delta Green.
Yeah.
Where there would actually be consequences for doing that horrible shit. And certainly, I remember a story about. There was an archaeologist who was in charge, I believe, of he was in charge of a site in Syria. And I'm not recalling the name of the site. It was actually a Roman site, and you know, ISIS executed him at the site. The site changed hands a bunch of times. You know, even some of the Russian mercenaries took it at one point. I want to say Wagner Group. And there are other special forces who were involved in Syria, took the site at one point and found that it had been booby-trapped from one side to another by ISIS. Hearing that guy's story about, you know, being dying protecting the site, you know, sort of inspired me to create the character of Assam, who was the old man who was guarding the amphora. The amphora that is definitely connected to the whole idea of Pandora's box, since Pandora's box is actually an amphora in the original mythology, if I remember it correctly. And I wanted to, you know, make sure that you know, as a tip of the hat to David Drake, who wrote what is, in my opinion, one of the best mythos short stories ever. He wrote a story called Than Curse the Darkness, as in it's better to light a candle than curse the darkness, where the story takes you into the Congo, into the Belgian Congo, King Leopold's Belgian Congo, and you get to witness King Leopold's troops commit one atrocity after another. And then the survivors of these atrocities summon Nyarlathotep to get theirs back. Yeah. And the whole idea behind the story is, why would anyone be a cultist? Well, ta-da! Humans can be so horrible that you can think, you know what I need? I need an elder god, you know, down here right now to sort this shit out is what I need. And
why would anyone be a cultist? Well, it has a lot to do with rubber.
Latex. It's going to come back to latex and the fact that none of my male relatives have any hands, you know? And so that story, if anyone has not read it, I highly recommend it. There's that line where the completely psychotic Call of Cthulhu investigator in the story, who has just gunned down all these locals, you know, and even gunned down some of his allies during the firefight because they smarted off to him. So he just shoots some of his own people to, you know, he gets down to the point where he's like, well, if they were the bad guys, that must make us the good guys. And I'm just like, okay. You know, yeah. That's one of the things I wanted to attach to the story is that feeling where, the ISIS has turned up in this sort of standing in for King Leopold and his, you know, force publique, and is abusing the locals. And if this avatar of Nyarlathotep gets out, there's always the possibility where someone's going to think, well, can't we just let it? Can't we just let it stay out and keep eating ISIS guys? You know, what about that as an option? What if we just let it burn through them for a while, you know? And I sort of hope that that was sort of one of the things that came up in the story is that, like, you know, there are characters who are of Yazidi background who are so desperate, in the face of the genocide of their people that they're like, you Americans want to put it back in the box. Oh, it needs to be in the box just yet. Maybe it could just keep being horrible.
I did enjoy the chapter near the end where you can start working with like Mosul battalions and the Yazidis and things like that. And it's like, they will help you. They are your best allies until the second you win. And then you're going to have a problem once they realize this is a weapon they could use on those assholes.
Can we turn this around? And I'm like, trust us, you don't want to. Yeah, you Americans have the luxury of saying, trust us, you don't want to turn it around. Yeah. But you're going to go home, and you're going to have a house that's not being shelled and a neighborhood that's not being burned to the ground.
And aircraft carriers about to turn around.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're so desperate, you can understand their thought that, wait a minute, why can't we, you know, it wants blood. Can't we get ISIL blood? You know, how about that for an idea, you know? And that is, of course, the ultimate temptation we've sort of laid out in all of Delta Green stuff is the mythos doesn't give a shit. It will take its feedings from whoever offers it a feeding, it offers it sustenance. And it will, to an extent, you know, you can aim it at people you don't like. Sure, there's a cost, but when your back's against the wall, that cost doesn't look so bad, you know? And that's a choice people always make in conflicts and in, you know, wars, is that there's always going to be a point where it's like, you know, what? Trying to remember who it was. Was it Churchill who said that they would make a deal with the devil if they could defeat the Nazis? So making nice with Stalin didn't seem nearly that bad.
Yeah, Churchill would have made a deal with the devil to refill his scotch glass. So not quite sure if that holds, but I agree.
Fair enough. You know, depends what Satan was offering that week. You know?
Yeah, exactly. What I enjoyed most about the campaign, like, I found myself as I read the campaign, like, a little angry I worked for Delta Green because, and like I hadn't written this one or like been involved in the playtesting of it, because the idea of the split between having to do so much of the campaign outside the war zone, mm-hmm. just jet setting and on phones around the Middle East playing intrigue games before you go in, and then you are committed. You are absolutely committed once you're in there.
There's a lot of logistical things to nail down, but if they're not nailed down when you go in, they're never going to hear from you again.
I just absolutely loved that. The like, well, I'll trade this Israeli intelligence to Quds Force, and I just won't tell my boss, and then he'll put me in contact with the Kurds, and then the Kurds will put me like, that was the red string. Potential of this campaign is like entirely up my alley. Yeah,
I hate to say it, but I think some of that was inspired by a MASH episode where Hawkeye wanted new boots.
Yeah,
there's this whole thing where he has to like make one deal after another, after another, after another. He just can't requisition new boots, you know. And at some point, you know, he's like, okay, you know what? Screw this. It's not worth it. Forget it. I'm not going to compromise my values or my integrity anymore just for a pair of boots. And he steps outside and steps right into a puddle.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, okay. What is it that guy, we need to make, we got to give Frank Burns a birthday party? Is that what we have to do? You know, and that idea of just, you know, this trail of favors and compromise in order to get this thing done, that really appealed to me. And it appealed to me in a way that, you know, it feels a little bit like I wanted to try and go behind the curtain of what the handler is doing. Like when the agents are sent into the breach, somewhere off screen, somebody has had to do all this shit, you know? And there's a point where the players are angry because the handler has lied to them. And, you know, as part of the operation, they ended up greasing like a cell of neo-Nazis that weren't like, you know, supernaturally connected. But that was so somebody at the ATF could, you know, be feel glad that they greased these Nazis who killed an ATF agent that they could ever pin it on, you know, and I wanted it to be kind of like that, you know, you're actually seeing behind the curtain where it's a lot of hands washing each other in order to get to an obvious good. You've got to put the gin back in the toothpaste tube, right? Mm-hmm. But everybody wants, even though you're doing something that would basically help everybody, you've got to bend over and do their dirty work and their scut work and get them what they need. Just to accomplish a which should be an obvious good, you know, that, you know, it's like, well, we could, how about we stop there being global warming and not have the seas rise up over the state of Florida? Yeah, what are you going to do for me? Well, you're in Florida, aren't you? Sure I am, but that's not good enough. We're going to have to hear more about what's in it for us besides not drowning. You know, It's kind of like that, and sadly, human nature seems really committed to this, you know, what's in it for me. Everything's got to be transactional. And so, yeah, that part of it was definitely hooked into the idea that you're going to get to see what your handler is doing off screen, the compromises that they're making, so that you can go in and grease the cultists, you know, and just shoot up a farmhouse or whatever. You know,
that makes me think it would be really fun to, I might try this on Patreon or something, but to put together a sampler of resources that your agents wish they had for a scenario. And when they don't, and they complain and bitch and moan about it to the case officer, because what do you mean we have to clean up the crime scene? None of us are crime scene people. Then, they come back to him, look, okay, all right, I might be able to get you somebody, but
yeah.
You've got to go do these three crimes, you know, and not get caught and not make them look like crimes.
Yeah.
I was really enamored. There seemed like a lot of ways to run it. Like when I was reading it, like I was really beset with the idea of mega gaming it, like doing a whole Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, you know, ducking through the streets of Cairo, trying to meet your contacts in different places, and paranoia and burned ops and lost assets.
Yeah,
and
all that if your players,
and then I deeply loved the idea of like using that to establish a baseline and then running it for four different characters who are just thrown into Mosul and told to go get them with the best the previous campaign could do. And I didn't really love the idea of like, well, yeah, you can listen to the episode later and see how badly they fucked you. But then I also like the idea of like, oh, maybe you switch characters after you've, maybe you tell them, well, you're going to do this for the other team. And then you end up playing the guys that you feed in the meat grinder. But I also love the idea of being like, you went to Georgetown, you got a 70% in Arabic, go get them. Like, you're going in, because that also seems very much like a program thing to do. Yeah, yeah.
This is what we got. One of the things that I'm hoping to do later is a Delta Green campaign that takes place over the 20th century. And the whole idea behind it is every scenario in the campaign sets up the information that is going to be used in the finale. So depending on how you do with these different teams separated by decades, you know, going along, eventually you'll put them together enough pieces to come to the conclusion of the scenario, but it's built by different teams over different eras. Some of them from the OSS age, some of them from the naval intelligence period, some of them from, you know, when Delta Green was official in the cowboy era and the program and the, you know, the outlaws, and that all these threads would come together. And what you're describing where, you know, the idea of using two teams was actually something I want to say that Shane sort of pushed on the idea, is that you don't have to have one team do everything. You can have this thing where, yes, there's a guy's doing all the legwork outside of Iraq, and there's a very specialized group who are going to go into Mosul and actually, you know, get in there and drop the hammer on the problem. But before they can do that, a lot of work has to be done so that they're not just sent in and told to improvise. You know, well, we got you to Mosul. Good luck. You know, you should totally put that god back in the bottle. That should be a thing. Yeah. And
yeah, I also love the idea of doing it as a campaign where you meet your characters first, like somebody's going down a hallway, one dude screaming because he watched the wrong video, you're going to interrogate some guy you kidnapped in Warsaw, and the guy with 80% hand of grades, like, what's going on? You're just like, don't shave, and you slam the door. You're getting to work on that, like,
grow my beard.
I loved that idea.
One of the things I was going to say about the sad news is, yeah, I had the inspiration in 2016 when Mosul first fell and Nineveh first got taken, and Persepolis as well, and that's when some of the big sort of ISIS videos came out desecrating these sites. But as time went by, I actually ended up learning a lot more about ISIS and their, you know, shitty behavior, to the point where it sort of, you know, we had this idea of ISIS as 21st century barbarians. And I think that was unfair because they're fascists. They're absolutely, yes, they've wrapped it up in Islam, but what they were executing was a fascist political agenda, a genocidal political agenda, with just the theocracy to make the fascism, you know, medicine go down a little easier, right?
Fascism also often derives from this, like, out of the ray, runaway capitalism in some ways, and in a lot of ways, ISIS like had a gap because of so many people from the Ba'ath Party and Saddam's. Mm-hmm. Secret Service being part of it. It's sort of like the capitalist fascist fell on hard times and then found the Quran and then came back strong in a lot of ways. Yeah. But they were using the same tactics. That's why the propaganda was so extreme. And yeah, mm-hmm. I would agree with that.
But so learning about that, I was sort of impressed with their capacity for evil. And the way that they found ways to get people to buy into the caliphate. particularly when it came to expropriating territory and land from people who were Shiite or Yazidi or politically incorrect or whatever they want to call it. You know, as there was a great article I read about how the agriculture department in Mosul was used to identify farmland that was owned by the wrong kind of people, seize it by the state, and then they'd put it up for disbursement, where if you were a Sunni in good standing, you could get it. And people lined up around the block to take their neighbor's land under the presumption, well, if I don't do it, somebody else will, so I might as well get Hassan's land, you know. Too bad for Hassan. I mean, what can I do? Except, I guess, you know, not take his land. Apparently, that's not a possibility. Mm-hmm. But the buy-in through distribution of seized property, very similar to what the Nazis did with the German Jews and Jews in occupied territories. That wealth was a way to get people to buy into the regime, buy into the program. It proved kind of irresistible in the 1940s, and it was just as irresistible, you know, in the teens here in the 21st century. That, you know, it's really a shame what happened to Hassan, but you know what? My land doubled. So I guess I'll just, you know, go along with the program, not, you know, cause trouble, not rock this boat. It's super creepy what people will sell out for. And usually the price is shockingly low.
I also found that interesting. Shane, you and I were talking a little bit about the Delta Green propensity towards door kicker type characters when, like, the government has such a endlessly varied background and set of skills. And what I do like about this is, like, if you want to play Mr. Run and Gun, bearded special ops guys, this is the place to do it. Also, like, there's a D20 table where everything's trying to kill you, and the people who aren't trying to kill you will profit greatly by telling the people who want to kill you where you are. And it is an absolutely hostile scenario. Yeah.
I feel like those encounter tables were highly highly influenced by old Twilight 2000 encounter tables. Mm-hmm. In post-apocalyptic Poland, where I love the idea that, well, we're sneaking across the border disguised as ISIL guys. Oh good, you just ran into SEAL Team 6, who's got a sniper on that butte, you know, who's going to, oh look, ISIS guys, we should totally shoot them. And I'm just like, oh wow, that, yeah, I realize.
Yeah, you're terrible. About to be in a middling memoir written 2 years from now. Good. Yeah, enjoy it. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, you can not have that done as long as you have your, you know, friend or foe identity, you know, stuff on you. But gee, that's going to look really bad when you actually run into ISIS people. So, yipes! It's all terrible.
The way the campaign is set up is as well as it's built so that you're way worse off if you don't have academics around to do the research, because the research potentially gets deeper and deeper and deeper. You know, there's a certain layer of it that you can get away with just knowing the right languages and knowing how to talk bureaucraties, but there's a lot of really valuable material that you'll just miss out on entirely if you don't have experts around.
I did love that the Winds of Unknown, tablet. Adad, Akkad. Yeah, I did love that, like, if you are the researcher character, like, everyone else is having fun in the ops center, Pamela Landy style, and you're going insane in the basement of the British Museum by yourself. Yeah.
Every part of the mission has its hazards, is all I'm saying, you know. Yeah. The academics pay their bill, and then the door kickers pay their bill. you know? Mm-hmm. And I keep thinking of, there's a couple of marvelous lines from the movie Spartan. You know what I'm talking about? It was it's a very small, low-budget David Mamet film. Where, you know, Val Kilmer plays the special ops guy who is on a special op. And then later his partner shows up and says, did we really do what we think we did? You know, maybe there's more going on here. And Kilmer, as the sort of perfect tool, is like, hey, you got to set your motherfucker to receive. You do not ask why. You know, the same, they don't have to go through the door. You don't have to ask why. That is freedom. Okay? You do not want to get bogged down in why. And, of course, he tells himself that. It turns out not to be true, you know. Mm-hmm. That, you know, and unfortunately asks why and finds himself in a world of shit. That whole thing of, you know, you can't do this without both sides of that equation. The door kickers do not get to be successful unless the squints and the book nerds do their goddamn work, you know? And hopefully
one of the challenges one of the challenges in the campaign was making both processes compelling and suspenseful. Yeah. Right. So that it was a, you know, the research is a process. It's sort of an adventure in itself, not a physical adventure, but you've got to find material. You've got to talk people into it. You've got to make hard decisions as to what you're going to give up to get access to it.
I had a question about, and this didn't appear in the book, but it was something we talked about when we initially playtested at Gen Con all those years ago. The name for this face of Nyarlathotep is the Father of War. I believe it was really the Father of Knives, and you had this very interesting sort of origin story based in actual history of the obsidian, like that you were talking about.
I will admit that the Father of Knives was an idea that was originally put together by Blair Reynolds.
Okay.
The late illustrator. And Father of Knives is actually the thing that's on the cover of the original Delta Green, that skinless character with the arms floating in the air and then holding the blades. The Father of Knives,
that's a cooler name. Yeah,
the Father of Knives shows up in some of the role-playing games that I had played with Blair over the years. Mm-hmm. And it was an aspect of Nyarlathotep that, you know, wasn't really, I mean, it was a new aspect. It was a new mask. You know, it hadn't appeared elsewhere. I chose not to publish it as the Father of Knives, which was my first instinct, because I didn't think I could sell Blair on letting me use it. Because he kept his work very close to the chest, and I just figured I needed to respect his privacy and his preferences in that case.
I was more referring to when you referenced the migration of Paleolithic instruments from a single stone quarry. Yeah.
Now, when I was playing around with the idea of the Father of Knives, the very first knife. Mm-hmm. Is going to be a flint instrument. And my friend Heather Hudson, who's also an illustrator, who's done a lot of work for Delta Green and a lot of work for Old Pagan products, she found this article about these quarry sites in Armenia, these volcanic quarry sites, where Stone Age communities were there for thousands of years mining obsidian and sending their obsidian blades, obsidian spear points, obsidian axe heads, obsidian arrow points, just all over the Mediterranean. It got everywhere. It got as far as Greece. It got all over Turkey. And the result was that we realized that how these spear points and axe heads are made is about chipping small pieces of obsidian off of the blow that you're going to create out of the block or the chunk of obsidian. I don't remember where exactly I got the idea that the father of knives, that this father, and part of the idea was these weapons, these axe blades, arrow points, and spear points were the best weapons available to Stone Age man in that time period. They were the super weapons. They were the weapons you could use not just to hunt, but you could use this to drive other cultures off of your land. You could use this to push and exterminate your competitors and commit Stone Age genocide and take over other people's hunting grounds as you expanded. And so I the idea that they had been able to identify the rocks from Armenia ending up all the way in the Aegean really struck me as like this idea that this was a weapons factory. This was an armaments factory. This was the Krupp factories of the 19th century Germany, providing weapons for whoever could pay the price. And anyone would, as long as they got these super sharp, super durable obsidian weapons so that they could push their enemies back. And it's the best thing until the Bronze Age. And frankly, what they know of the site in Armenia, they were still making obsidian spear points and arrowheads well into the Bronze Age. Because say what you like about bronze, it's not as sharp as obsidian. And so at some point I had this idea that those chips, each one of those strikes against the obsidian rock to knock a piece of obsidian off, to hammer it down till it became an actual arrowhead or spear point, all of those would be sort of infused with the power of the father of war. Because one of the things they talked about in the article that Heather sent me was just the massive amounts of just obsidian chips that were found at the site. Just huge piles, middens.
Industrial waste product.
The industrial waste product of a weapons manufacturing system, And the idea of the father living in those as much as it lives in the weapon that is plunged into an aurex or a woolly mammoth or another human or a Neanderthal or whatever, really sort of resounded with me. And that's, I guess, sort of the moment where I realized what the father would be, that it would be this, it would be obsidian. It would be the first knives. It would be the first blades. It would be the first instruments of war that humanity reached for. And part of that, of course, is related to all the old stories that exist where there's a number of, like, the Dark Demon. I can't remember if it's a Robert Bloch story or not. It might be, where Narlathotep whispers the secrets of the H-bomb and the A-bomb to the folks at the Manhattan Project, creating a new weapon for mankind to thin itself out with. And, of course, that's fine and dandy, having Narlathotep tell you about how to make an atom bomb. But when you're in the Stone Age, that doesn't help.
That's your atom bomb, yeah.
What's Narlathotep going to tell you about? Narlathotep's going to tell you about obsidian.
I did also love the swallowing of the chips as a way of being recruited in the Son of War. I also especially love the line where you talk about the way that they can be expelled with the Elder Sign. And I just had this image of a co-opted CIA agent, walking backwards into the trailer, trying to all right, I want it to come out the front. Jimmy, could you get me a Corman? Just slowly.
Because this is what happened. It's going to leave. And it's going to be messy. Yeah.
Yeah. Go on.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I was going to say, yes, the sacrament was definitely a tip of the hat at a couple of things, not the least of which was the laundry series. They did they did a Charles Strauss did a thing involving creepy evangelicals taking as the sacrament the horrible transdimensional insect that will then crawl up their throat and eat their tongue and live in their mouth like a sea louse. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that concept of taking the sacrament that definitely influenced me a little about the idea of swallowing the chip that has the soul of Narlothotep attached to it to keep the brotherhood loyal and on the right path. Yeah,
there's nothing Delta Green loves more than a failed interrogation. You gotta love, like, just the victory of, we got the guy, and then it goes horrifically way worse than you could ever want.
Yeah, it's suddenly that scene from Scanners back in, you know, 1981 or whatever. It's bluff. And his heads explode. It's like, huh, guess we're gonna have to plan for that for the next one. Maybe put up some shower curtains or something. that didn't work quite the way we were hoping to. Absolutely. There have been a number of failed interrogations over the years.
Yeah,
that have been particularly memorable.
All right. I believe we've been collecting some questions from the chat. You've been doing so, Baz, which yes. I appreciate. Uh-huh. You want to get into some of those?
Hello. Just the silent watcher back here. Oh, my mic's not even on.
No, we hear you.
They don't.
I hear you.
They don't. Oh, they don't. Yeah.
God. Oh, there it goes. Okay, cool. Now it's kind of picking it up. I have a filter on there.
Yeah, we'll take
it. I'll try and repeat the question.
Yeah.
Here we go. Okay, cool. Yeah, my filters were set. Kind of weird. Okay, first question up is from Tristan. They had to leave, unfortunately, but they did leave a question that they wanted asked. How would you recommend playing with the campaign materials in an ancient setting around the same region? I'm investigating Mythos Babylon as a possible setting system.
Well, you know, the part of the answer is the problem's still there. It's certainly available in the ancient time period if you wanted to. It depends where how ancient you want to go. Do you want to go as far back as the Assyrians? Do you want to go as far back as the Babylonians? Do you want to go as far back as the recent history, Islam taking that area away from the Byzantine Empire? And, you know, then you've got, good Lord, I mean, the Ottoman Turks, the Seljuk Turks, the frickin' Mongols roll through and turn everything into a parking lot circa 1200 AD, you know, it depends how ancient you want to go. Certainly, the good news about playing in an ancient setting is that there should be no trouble buying into the idea that there's a supernatural problem. Supernatural isn't a thing in the ancient world. That's just the world. You know, you don't have to take that step where you go, yeah, of course, you know, there's a dragon, it eats the moon, you know, whatever. You know, you realize you live in a world of, in a demon haunted world. If they mean like really ancient, like Epic of Gilgamesh ancient, the good news is that if I was to play it in that time period, I would certainly make the access to mythos or unnatural magic more available to the players in order to defeat the problem. They're going to take a massive hit to their sand points and their power and other things that they're going to have to burn to put the problem back in, you know, put the monster back in the toothpaste tube. But they'd certainly not have to, you know, parse through, well, this is just a legend, you know, let me summarize the legend. They're going to be faced with, my understanding of particularly of Babylonian religions was that they have a fair number of things in their religions that aren't gods as we understand them in the Greco-Roman sort of Egyptian idea of gods, they have a lot of demons that are in their religion that they have to placate. They're shitty. They're terrible. You're not worshiping them because you love the demon of plagues. You're doing it to just keep him at bay.
The bull of heaven just acts like a bull in heaven. Yeah. Like, he's not doing cool shit for you. He's wrecking the place. Yeah.
So, you know, it's all about holding that chaos at bay and abating the damage, you know. So, my thought would be that they are doing it in the ancient times. The good news is the players are not equipped with high-tech items that will give them a false confidence that will get them killed. All right, that's a big thing. When you realize, no, I don't have a 50-round magazine I can just slap in and out of this, you know, weapon. I have a bronze sword, you know. You're going to be super careful, and you're going to take your shot very carefully when it comes to taking a poke at this god, because there's not going to be a second try. There's not going to be a plan B. If plan A fails, you're just skinned, you know.
Yeah, a modern player is going to know that the bronze sword is probably not up to killing the god. But you've given him M4, which is in many ways less effective against a swarm of Sigi and Obsidian. Like, yeah, they're going to go in there. Leroy Jenkins.
I mean, guns are the you know, it's been guns have always been the whoopee for weird horror, where you think, you know, I'm going to go down that slimy cave, and I have a flashlight. He's like, well, I'm not going to go down in the slimy cave. I have an Uzi. Okay, we're going down the slimy cave. You know, guns are there to get you to do shit that you should know not to do, you know? So, you know, hopefully if they're just armed with some, bronze spears or iron-tipped, you know, swords or whatever, they're going to be really careful. I found that when we were playing,
wait till they get a good weapon, like a guy who knows how to read. Like,
assault rifle for the warrior of ancient days is going to be the 20 guys that you're in charge of that you send in there to do shit and stab it.
I
was just thinking that yes, literacy may be your best weapon in that scenario. Do you have anyone who can read Akkadian? You know. that's my thought on doing it in an ancient setting, is that thank goodness they don't have to wrestle with whether or not this is real. They can just accept that this is some fucked up shit and the world is fucked up and they need to adapt immediately to how to
fix it. There would still be a lot of room though for the challenges of finding the right answers to the problem. You know, because not every temple you go to is going to know how to make the real elder sign, right? And half the temples you go to are going to call you, you know, some kind of horrible necromancer who needs to be skinned for wanting to make a real elder sign in the first place. So you've got room for the need for that kind of research and creeping around, and there's all kinds
of stuff around the Aegean in your trireme, you know, to get to some temple in Crete or, you know, Minoan Greece in order to pick up the clues so that you can go back to the Levant and then hike across, you know, Lebanon and get back to Syria and solve the problem. I mean, that's some flat out Jason and the Argonauts shit right there. You know, you're going to have to put a lot of mileage on to solve this problem, and you're going to end up.
I want to warn the players though that a trireme is way bigger than an extreme expense.
Yeah, fair. That's fair. Yeah.
Another thing you could do is I would go Valhalla Rising. I would make it hallucinogenic. Like, well, yeah, you can learn how to do this. Go to the Dreamlands. This guy will give you a thing to smoke, and you could go on an epic journey. And then,
there's an old hoary guy with a long beard and weird, you know, kind of wiry muscles, kind of like Scott Glenn, you know, with a big beard. And he'll tell you exactly how to fix this, so long as you don't mind swearing your allegiance to Nodens. That'll be, yeah, absolutely. You can fix that shit in the Dreamlands, no problem. Good luck with the rest of your life, but, you know.
Yeah.
If you want to fuck up Narlathotep, I know a guy.
It would be fun to. It would be fun on that setting to, as well to make the border between the real world and the craziness of the Dreamlands a lot more fungible. You know, a lot blurrier, right? Like if you were to, if you look at the Dreamlands, the traditional Dreamlands of Lovecraft, it sort of starts with the ancient world as we know it, right? Mm-hmm. So if that's where it begins, then it's like you're just taking a few steps into the real craziness of the Dreamlands from something from a real world that doesn't look too dissimilar from it most of the time.
No. Oh no, I've gone to the Dreamlands. My bronze sword is now a bronze sword.
Yeah. are you passed through a fog bank on the Aegean and then you see a black galley or something like that? Yeah.
Yeah. That's not that big a deal for them. Mm-hmm. For the ancient world. Yeah.
All right.
Baz, hit us with another question.
This might be more directed towards Ivy, since you're the kind of the boss here. Think of the Arc Dream. Turk Accented asks, has this adventure had a chance to be run through by sensitivity readers and cultural advisors? I know the idea of sensitivity sounds a bit silly with how DG is so much about horror, but I'm curious about running and would like to give my players a good heads up.
Yeah, absolutely. I recruited a few different people, Muslims and Arabic speakers and Muslim gamers as well, to look through the thing, and they were invaluable in helping to sort of tease out elements that Scott and I, with our backgrounds, wouldn't occur to us to pay really strict attention. And there were a few things that came up, and it was really, really useful to do that. And I don't think it's a silly question at all, least of all in Delta Green, because Delta Green deals with horrors that affect the world around us. And it sort of puts those horrors into the lens of the fantastic, to sort of give you this cathartic way to shoot death in the face once in a while. But even so, it's really important that you show some respect to the real world in order to make it meaningful and potent.
We're in the fiction that you're giving. In the real world. The whole point is that we're in the real world. And the idea is that if we can make the world around the supernatural horror as realistic as possible, then that adds to our cachet, our credibility, when we actually diverge from reality. You know, if everything else is right, and then suddenly out of the frickin' blue, there's the monster made out of a swirling cloud of obsidian shards. If everything else was on the money, then that just helps us.
Yeah. So it was, that process in this setting especially was invaluable, not just in helping to prevent me and Scott from being accidentally racist, which is entirely possible, when you're a middle-aged white dude in America, right, mm-hmm. from a middle-class background, no matter how well-read you are or how good your intentions may be. It was valuable for that, and it was valuable for and it's extremely valuable for just getting the details and the gist, the nuances of the world.
One second.
Right.
Baz made a timeout. I don't know why Baz made time, and he left again. All right.
Well, we'll keep our mouths shut.
He's up to.
All right.
Gotta love that.
Hello.
So.
Hey, he's back.
Baz, sorry, Discord just completely shit on me.
Oh, no.
Let me
put you're back. So
he's got to get our
what is Twitch seeing right now?
Twitch is seeing
they're seeing some weird windows, but it's fine. They can hear.
Yeah.
Okay.
They can hear us still. So
yeah.
So watch it, Scott.
My OnlyFans picks were put away beforehand, so it's all good.
Okay. Hit us with another question.
Fatkiss asks, glad to see you're doing a Q&A. Any chance Glancy can provide some recommendations for research material to flesh out the campaign, political, social, and historical, etc.? Jesus Christ, we fucked up by asking this question.
I think that's a Baz addition. Probably not. Probably not from the listener.
Why don't we leave it there? Because that's already a kind of a big question.
Yeah,
I take it there's a lot more questions still to come.
There are more
questions. I would have to say that one of the things that I would absolutely recommend that any gamer do is go over and look up the film Mosul. MOSUL. All right. This film was made by Americans, but it has no English in it. It was absolutely filmed in Arabic. And it shows a group of Iraqi officers, members of the Nineveh SWAT team, which are former police officers who were assigned to Mosul, returning to Mosul on a special mission that they have cooked up on their own. They have sort of gone off the reservation in true Delta Green style, and they have cooked up this mission that they're doing, and it takes place in the city of Mosul pretty much about like 6 months after the game is set. All right. It takes place after the actual events of Iconoclasts. It was directed by an American named, Carnahan, Matthew Michael Carnahan. All right. Who also wrote it. And it is maybe, it's hard to downplay how this may be the movie about the Iraq War, because it's 100% from the Iraqis' point of view and where their world is. And, there's a sequence where they're fighting over their city. The characters in the film are fighting over their city, a city that they were driven out of by ISIS. And when the option comes up, well, maybe we can call the Americans for an airstrike. Somebody says, oh, the Americans will flatten the entire block and then we'll just have to rebuild it. You know, no, don't call the Americans. They'll just blow up everything, you know? And you realize you get this amazing feeling about how these guys are connected to this place, right down to where they're working their way through back alleys to catch up on ISIL. And at the same, and they're like, yeah, we used to duck down these alleys when I was a kid when we would throw rocks at the Americans. And you're like, oh, shit. We have been in Iraq long enough for a guy to start off as a kid throwing rocks at Americans and running away down alleys. And now
he's trained in counterterrorism by the Americans and then abandoned by the Americans and then readopted by the Americans. Yeah,
exactly. You know, it is a really amazing film. It showed up on Netflix where I first saw it. And I am hard pressed to come up with a film that did a better look at combat. Combat is chaotic. The main characters are extremely skilled, but they still do shit like accidentally shoot guys who run in front of their line of fire, you know? Everything is about one fumble roll after another, you know? It's really, it's everything that I wanted Black Hawk Down to be as a movie. When I read the book Black Hawk Down, I thought it was one of the most astounding descriptions of combat, in that Mark Bowden pretty much had the ability to describe every single wound received by every single American serviceman during that conflict. And because it was 120 guys wounded and like, you know, 19 or 29 that Grolon Wrecks had killed. And he could actually go and describe every single instance where a bullet or a fragment of metal impacted human meat, you know? And those descriptions were horrifying. I did not get that in the movie. Thank you, Ridley Scott. This sort of very personal encounter with, you know, meat and blood and high velocity metal is everything that the movie Mosul is about. And I would highly recommend that you take a look at that to get a good idea of the kind of combat the players might be facing in Mosul. Obviously, Mosul is set during a time when ISIS is pushed, you know, their backs are against the wall. They're absolutely failing in the face of the Kurds, the Shiites, the Iraqi army, all pushing in on them from every direction.
Yeah, I think it's like months away from the push on Raqqa, even. Like, Mosul's about to go down for good. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I would recommend that. Now, most everything else I got was from news sources.
The one thing. Baz, we need a new question before he goes to the bookshelf. Hurry up. We got to go. There's only so much stream we can do. Keep moving.
All right. Magnificent Top Hat says, I really like the investigative preamble, but it feels like the finale boils down to resolving various interpretations of the Elder Signs rules. I was wondering if folks had thought of fun ways to telegraph those rules or lessen the reliance on manipulating them.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that before. That is definitely outside my outside what I was expecting. I included a section that was like, there are no easy answers, right? You can fuck up the cult of the Father of War in various ways. Some answers are more permanent than others. I did not create a step one, step two, step three way to put the Father of War back in the amphora and call it good. Part of that was to sort of imply the idea that the unnatural doesn't obey fictional tropes, you know, much like the world doesn't obey fictional tropes. Once it's out, it's out. This is a new thing you're going to have to deal with. It is going to migrate to the next place where bloodletting is a thing. And there are going to be people. I mean, somewhere out there, there are some guys from GRUSV8 trying to figure out how to get the Father of War on their side so they can break the siege of Kiev, or Kharkov now, since they've clearly failed to break Kiev. You know, and there's going to be somebody who's going to be trying to find a way to make this work for their interests.
Telegraphing
stuff about the Elder Sign is something you would want to do, especially in the research phase, you know, the intelligence gathering phase.
Great.
Starting with the initial briefing, right, where you see what's happening, you know, and you see what caused it, and that's going to be your first clue as to a possible solution. But even beyond that, if you send your academics out, you know, to study the Nicotic manuscripts in Greece, or to try to piece together enough of when Zenon to Adad in Baghdad and London to be useful, then start to sort of seed those with the additional information you want the players to have.
Yeah, I think there's also a lot of opportunities in the book to sort of tell an on the body, more visceral story of like what that weird symbol does. Like the fact that the amphora is a literal portal and like other shit can stick its hand up. I think that tells the player something about, oh, this thing on the lid is very important. Or like, this wouldn't be, we would be dealing with this sooner than now if the lid didn't work. Or, I mean, you bring your Chechen guy back to your Air Force base for a rendition and a piece of obsidian goes flying out his west side while your trailer with the elder signs on the east side. Like, you're getting clues that way that they can hopefully, you know, figure out once they stop that guy from bleeding out.
Yeah. And of course, there's a whole conversation that the players will have with an NPC early on.
Yeah, Sloan is also very
that can clued in. Provide as many additional little tidbits about possibilities of the Elder Sign as you want.
Even with Sam's journals, point you in the direction of the Elder Sign. I hope they do.
Not a question, but I absolutely loved Sloan getting to retire. He's like, yeah, I just brought the news. I quit. he was my favorite character in all the thing. He's like, I'm burnt now. I'm going home.
Yeah.
What's up, bitches?
We have another question from NCC360, who asks, before I forget, how would you handle a player casting the Immortal Messenger? Given that it summons Nyarth Lothotep, how would you suggest resolving it? Would it bring about a different avatar in the mix?
I mean, avatar is right there. Why would you want another one?
Yeah.
Just have the father show up and answer the call.
Oops, all Nyarth Lothotep.
I don't know what they think's going to happen when they sovereign Nyarth Lothotep avatar and go sit that avatar.
Well, that would be a great way to find out that this is actually an avatar of Nyarl Thotep. Spoiler alert.
It would certainly confirm.
You're right. That's your best case scenario right there, is if somebody bothers to use Immortal Messenger, hoping that that's going to provide them with a clue that, oops. Well, whoever survives this encounter or sees the recording of it 6 months from now will have some interesting new intelligence.
Should report that was not a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah. I want the player so resistant to metagaming that their solution to this problem is, let's ask Nyarl Lothotep to take care of it for us. I want that guy in my game. Like, that is an amazing level of lack of character awareness. Just beautiful. That'd be like when Stolze crit failed at his knowledge check. He's like, well, it's definitely vampires.
That was one of the greatest moments in gaming tabletop history. Was it's vampires, you should get garlic and steaks.
I'm
back in the cave now, and it worked. It absolutely worked. Yeah, that was fabulous.
Kaiju biologist asks, how do you do balance? How do you do balance possible agent desire to just use DG's resources to destroy the entirety of ISIL rather than just this one cult within ISIL?
Oh, how do you balance DG's allocation of resources to the fight? Okay.
I think it's pretty simple.
I am 100% in favor. I am 100% in favor of the players going, we should just carpet bomb it. You know, because that's not effective, ultimately. Right.
You got to bear in mind, Delta Green is only this little minuscule parasitic growth on the neck of the U.S. government, and the U.S. government in its entirety couldn't kill off ISIL when it wanted to. So,
not like this, but they could inflict damage like, what was that town that the Kurds had control of that they absolutely packed in the ISIS guys 10 deep around that town, and then the U.S. Air Force came over and just bombed the shit out of them?
I don't remember the town, but...
Yeah, it was right there on the Turkish border where the Turks were letting ISIS recruits leave Turkey to join... the forces besieging the town, and were simultaneously cutting off the town from, Kurdish
free boat raffle down at the police station.
And exactly. And Turks were being super douchey about the whole thing, but The result was is that they packed in the ISIS guys, you know, again, like 10 deep, and then let the U.S. Air Force do what the U.S. Air Force does, which is fuck up stationary targets. You know, it was pretty awesome when that happened. But, you know, the air, you know, you can do that in little groups. You know, you can erode ISIS through encounters like that. And the idea that the players just go, look, we're just going to use our ability to affect the U.S. government to make more bombing raids happen. My thought would be like, well, it turns out exactly like history says. The caliphate dies.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't help but notice that there are still news reports showing up out there in the Arabic world, in the Levant, in Syria, in Iraq, of skinned bodies still turning up. You know, you didn't fix that. You know, you may have fixed the caliphate, but they scurried off sideways. And who knows, maybe it's now in Armenia. Maybe it's part of the reason that Armenia lost their war with Azerbaijan recently over Nagorno-Karabakh, because you thought you could fix the problem just with, you know, maybe we should just throw more firepower at the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And another thing, you can use the U.S. military to limit the U.S. military impact against ISIL. Like I at another, you know, many points in the campaign, I think if I was running it, I would make requisitions harder based on like what we've done. Well, we dropped a bomb on it. It was like, well, no, that didn't eliminate the threat. Should we drop another bomb on it? Like, like, I mean, it's the U.S., but they have a way of dealing with things. When you're like, no, I want to send four guys in there to get murdered on TV to show at the news back home. They're going to be like, fuck no, we'll drop a third bomb on it. Like, yeah, we'll keep doing the thing that doesn't work because that one's cheaper. And if that pilot dies, we'll just say it was an engine malfunction. Yeah. But I am not sending some guys to get in there on the news. Yeah.
Yeah. Not to mention that, you know, we dropped a bomb on it. We literally, at some point, you're in a situation where you could be dropping bombs on a cultural heritage site.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what Nineveh is.
Yeah.
You know, how many times can you get away with that before you've got questions to answer in front of Congress or The Hague? You know, don't want to do that. You want to make sure you get the right solution before you pull the trigger. And I don't mind that players might get the wrong solution before they pull the trigger. That's fucking realistic. You know?
Yeah, I'd also say, like, there's a chance of them being punished for being effective, like, which is also a thing that happens a lot in organizations.
All the time.
Yeah, like, oh, yeah, you're making big moves in the intelligence field. Fuck you. You fucked up everything. Now my contact over here at Mossad won't talk to me, and this guy's pissed off, and this asset's burnt. Like, yeah, there's all sorts of other people who are going to be very angry that you're in their wheelhouse being effective. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, you ought to have intelligence officers whose existence you've never heard of convincing themselves that your agents are gunning for them and trying to get them burnt, and therefore they have to fuck with them. Mm. Yeah,
that's beautiful, Shane. Thank you.
We have a question here that I'm actually qualified to answer. Can you have the Air Force airstrike the Avatar of Nihilus Step? As an agent who has served in Cambodia before in a Delta Green game, you certainly can. It just no one else makes it out. I think the Avatar was just fine.
You can. All that bed will teach you that, 500-pound, 2,000-pound bombs don't mean shit to an Avatar of Nihilothotep. But if you want to demonstrate how badass Nihilothotep is, sure. Arrange for a B-52 strike on Nineveh.
I'll tell you. It's super effective against Avatars of Baz, though. Boy. Just a memory was left behind.
Ouch. What's another one, Baz? Yeah.
Let's see. I'm curious if the ADS hard suit is something that ever got used in a playtest, or if that's just a neat idea y'all wanted to include.
I included it in case somebody had the idea, because I thought it was possible. But I have never played the scenario in a way where people had thought, I'm going to fucking tiptoe a tiny little step at a time wearing this hundreds of pounds suit.
You know what I read about on Wikipedia the other day? The player saying, No, I didn't see that either when I was playtesting it, but, you know, fingers crossed. If that happens in your campaign, we want to hear how it went.
Yeah.
When my cat when I'm working and I don't want my cat to lay on the keyboard so I can't work, I'll like cat trap. I'll make like a box and like lay out some blankets and like a really nice appealing space. Like, I felt like that sidebar was meant for that one player in your campaign. You know who he is. It's definitely a he. You know absolutely that guy. And that's the cat trap. Send him to that page. Be like, yeah, all right. Our new mission is for you to get.
Smuggle a hard suit into Mosul.
Right.
Motherfucker. You know?
I just imagine some Jacques Cousteau guy on the ocean smoking a cigarette, giving you a blank stare at the request. Like, you need it for what?
the ISIS guys, like, you fuck it up and you'd like paradrop the suit outside of Mosul and you fuck up picking it up. And the ISIS guys are like, why is there a fucking deep sea diving suit being sent to Mosul? What are the Yankees up to, you know? It's like,
this is some kind of 4D chess thing the Americans have come up with.
Mm-hmm. All right, I think unless anyone else likes to throw one more before we close it up on the questions, we are out of questions.
Did you have one in that mega question that we cut the poor guy off?
Oh.
He was talking about the influences.
He asked about influences for that, and I was like, you get one, Glancy, you get one influence. Oh, otherwise, okay. we'll be here until midnight.
Mosul's the big one. General news reporting is worthwhile.
There's a tremendous number of outstanding newspaper series and academic journals and not political journals, but public policy journals that are all online and readily available.
Al Jazeera may have problems reporting on other areas, but Al Jazeera does a great job on reporting in the Middle East. I'm pretty happy with their coverage on a lot of stuff. So, you know, you can certainly dive into that and get a lot of interesting information. Same thing with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, Haaretz, they do a pretty good job covering Middle East and, material about the Fertile Crescent, you know, everything from, the Gulf of the Persian Gulf all the way to Lebanon. They do a pretty good job on that. Those are the places I would send people to if they're.
Yeah, in general, I'd stay out of the U.S. No one cares what the National Review thinks is going on in Iraq at any given moment. Like, you shouldn't care what the National Review thinks you should buy out of a vending machine, not to mention.
Yeah. Well, the Washington, I think, if I remember right, the Washington Post had some pretty good material. The Guardian had a lot of good material. There's a lot out there. Yeah. That's not that hard, you know, to find, and that'll get you into some really interesting details.
You know, just remember, kids, it's going to be super terrible. Like I said, ISIS, ISIL, the caliphate seemed dedicated to being everything they warned us that Islamic extremism will be. You know what I mean? They it's like, you know, it's like Stalin when people talk about communism or Pol Pot. You know, it's the absolute, you know, cutting edge of most crazy bullshit you could imagine.
The Dulles brothers with America.
Yeah, it's like, what if everything the Dulles brothers thought was true was real? You know, this is it. Absolutely. You know, and yeah, it's sorry, my brain immediately ricocheted to my favorite scene in Mosul where the Iraqi and the Iranian argue.
Mm-hmm.
Where the Iranian is like, you haven't had a real country since Babylon. Iraq is just a mistake on a map made by drunken British bureaucrats and French diplomats. And I'm just like, whoa, that is... Stop talking now. Someone's feelings are going to get hurt. And someone's going to get stabbed. Okay? Stop talking right now. Yeah, that was... one of my favorite moments in the film where the Iraqi and the Iranian are trading barbs about whose country, whose nation state is less legitimate. And it's like, as long as they don't mention the British and the French, you know, European imperialism is safe. You know, oops, they did. Yeah. It's a mess that's been left behind, and we're still dealing with it. You know, one of the things that made ISIL legitimate was attacking the Sykes-Picot Treaty, which is super creepy. The idea that they were able to pull out those boundaries that were created after the fall of the Ottoman Empire and go, this agreement between France and Britain is illegitimate. And oops, they're right. You know, now,
yeah, you're not wrong. You're just an asshole. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. The fact that you can then go, okay, the border's not right. The part where you're murdering all the Yazidis is still fucked up. You don't buy any, you know. Oh yeah, the British and the French messed up your border. Genocide is clearly the answer to that problem. You know, no, it is not. Thank you very much.
As you had, I think we can end that on genocide's not the answer.
Hey, if we take anything from tonight's stream, genocide is the fact.
Yes, if you walk away from this with anything, please take away genocide is not the answer ever. Fucking ever.
All right.
I can live with that.
Y'all want to send yourselves off?
Yeah, so thanks for watching, everybody. We'll do this a little bit more periodically. We have all podcast mirrors of this, if you don't like seeing our beautiful faces, that will be available on Delta Green Dead channels. I will also try and do my best to clean up the audio a bit, and we will get this posted on the Delta Green YouTube channel as well once the VOD goes down on Twitch, which should be about 2 weeks, right, Baez? Yeah, so in about 2 weeks, this will go off our VOD, but we'll have that up on YouTube. So, and if you want a podcast version of it and other stuff, you can back me at Delta Green Dead Channels. And you can go buy Iconoclast right now. DTRPG and various other fine places.
Push me back up to number 2 on DriveThruRPG, as I sadly dropped to number 3 on DriveThruRPG.
Oh my god, you peon. You barely deserve to be on the internet. A mere 3?
Yeah. Exactly.
Why didn't you tell me before we agreed to do this?
he thought he was doing something important here.
Yeah, I thought I was talking to a number 1, a number 2 at least. Yeah.
I had 9 days at number 1. 9.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We really appreciate you joining us, and have a good one, and tell us how your play of Iconoclast go.
We have a quick thing. I want to say some thank yous to everyone.
Yeah.
Zazzy Does Stuff for the follow, Magnificent Top Hat for the follow, Not Haspis followed, Rev Nax 42 followed, Not Punished, subscribed for, they've been subscribed for 9 months.
Thank you.
Mr. Alex Reynolds says resubscribed at 5 months. G-Man 1980 subscribed for 6 months. Brownie with 100 bits early on. Dork Assassin followed us. Little Miss Skittles has followed. Honested has subscribed. And DK Wings resubscribed at 4 months in a row. That's 6 total months. Super rad. Lots of support. Lots of
love. If you're new to Twitch, you get a free subscription through Amazon Prime. So throw that our way, and Glancy won't have to eat his cat pie, depending on the numbers.
For everyone.
Yeah. all right.
None of us want cat pie.
Thanks for moderating, Baz. I appreciate you pressing all the buttons and stuff that are too complex for me.
You're welcome. Sorry, Discord was Discord earlier during the stream.
It always is, isn't it?
Yeah. It's hard to complain too much about a free thing that does such great things for us, but man, it really fucked us on that one.
But we'll be back doing something soon. So thanks for watching, and everybody have a good night. Bye.
Thanks, guys.
Adios.